All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Sri Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Vishnu Prasaya Bhutale Sri Mati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namine. Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pacharne Nirvasesa Sunyavani Paskatyade Satarne. Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yuta Padakamalam Sri Guru and Vaishnavamscha Sri Rupam Sagradatam Sagana Raghunatham Vitam Sam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvaditam Varijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakam Vitamscha Panchakalpa Trivascha Kipasindhya Vitapati Tanam Pavanevyo Vaishnavya Namaha Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
It's full of ants.
Oh, sorry.
That's all right. That's it. So it's February 24th, 2017. In Mauritius, and we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 6, Creation of the Universal Form, Text 11. Atatasya bitaptasya katidayantananiha nirabhidyanta devanam tani me garata shrinu. Therefore, tasya, his, abhitaptasya, in terms of his contemplation, katida, how many, ayatanani, embodiments, ha, there were nirabhidyanta, by separated parts, devana, of the demigods, tani, all those, me garata, described by me, shrinu, just here, translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Maitreya said, you may now hear from me how the Supreme Lord separated himself into the diverse forms of the demigods after the manifestation of the gigantic universal form. Purport. The demigods are separated parts and parcels of the Supreme Lord, as are all other living entities. The only difference between the demigods and the ordinary living entities is that when the living entities are rich in pious acts of devotional service to the Lord, and when their desire to lord it over material nature has vanished, they are promoted to the post of demigods, who are entrusted by the Lord with executing the management of the universal affairs. Atas tasya bitaptasya katidaya tananiha nirabhidyanta devanam tani me garatashrinu. Maitreya said, you may now hear from me how the Supreme Lord separated himself into the diverse forms of the demigods after the manifestation of the gigantic universal form. So these demigods, of course, are described in every tradition of the world, every religious tradition, and even ordinary people sometimes have experiences of interrelating with higher celestial beings. So in the, you know, the Christians, the Muslims, the Jews, they call them angels. But the principle is there, that there's higher beings in the universe. The universe is a personal universe. It's not an impersonal universe. Modern science tells us that everything is impersonal. When they want to describe nature, they describe it impersonally and mechanically. There was one gentleman who one time, one devotee, who gave us a video for our Gurukula, how the universe was created. So of course it was interesting that somebody was there to take a video. But
It said, when you look at the origin of the universe, you must conclude that it was a cold, impersonal machine. And you wonder why people want to live in a world that they think is run by a cold, impersonal machine. Why do they want to have such a philosophy that things are not run by persons? I remember also my daughter was looking at a book in our Whirlpool library about thunder and lightning. And it was saying, the words was very interesting. It said, primitive people used to believe, it used believe, imagine, that there were gods in the sky who were making the thunder and lightning. It said, but now we know, so it used imagine and believe and know and primitive. Now we scientific people know that really it's just electricity. But what was the most interesting thing is at the end in the book it said, but we still do not know what causes thunder and lightning. So they weren't comparing the same things. They were saying primitive people imagined or believed that other beings caused, and we don't know what causes, but we can say what it is, it's electricity, but we don't know actually what it's caused by. So, you know, people who are not very thoughtful, they read these things, they hear these things, and they think, oh, now we are advanced. We know it's electricity. But this is just like you look at these paintings, and you can say, ah, it's canvas and pigment and oil. That's what it is. But that doesn't tell you what is the cause. It doesn't explain the cause. And if we look at these paintings and we say, the cause is a cold, impersonal machine, would anybody agree? Is that possible? That something like that can be produced by a cold, impersonal machine? And that is just a painting. Yes, it's a painting. There's flowers in the painting. What to speak of where the actual flowers come from? So everything is done by persons. And you might say, well, why doesn't God just create alone? What is the need for these demigods? It's very interesting if you read the original language in the Bible. It says gods. It's in the plural. It's not in the singular. And this problem has beset the Jews and the Christians for a very long time. What do we do with the fact that there's plural for creation? We know that there must be only one God ultimately. How do we know? Where in the Bhagavatam is it described that ultimately there must be one God? What is the logical evidence? Anybody know where in the Bhagavatam the logical evidence is given? It's in verses, not in purports. It's in verses. Okay, I'll give you a little hint. It's in the sixth canto. Beginning of the sixth canto. Yes. Krishna's two Bhagavad Swayam, very nice. That's in the first canto. And that's a statement. And that's a statement, of course, not so much about the demigods, but about all the incarnations. So there's so many incarnations, but Krishna is the source of the incarnations. But that was very nice. I went to a lecture in Russia a few months ago. Bhaktivedanta Swami was giving just about this verse, Krishna's two Bhagavad Swayam. He was going into depth about how there is an avatar and avatari. But here we're looking not so much at Krishna and the avatars, but Krishna and the demigods. So this is in the sixth canto. What happens at the beginning of the sixth canto? Anybody know the story that's at the beginning of the sixth canto? So the fifth canto ends with the hellish planets, right? And then Maharaj Purkhit says, how does anyone get free from the hellish planets? And Sukadev Goswami says, by atonement. Am I speaking slowly enough for everybody? Can you all understand my English? It's okay?
Yes.
And then Maharaj Purkhit said, no, no, this atonement is not going to work. It's like an elephant taking a bath. The elephant takes a bath, then puts dirt on again. Or maybe like a two-year-old taking a bath also, same. And then Sukadeva Goswami said, well, what will free one from all sins? And Amarj Prakrit asked, and then Sukadeva Goswami said, the chanting of the holy name. So what story was told to illustrate that? Ajamila, yes. Now you remember with the Ajamila story, two sets of persons came when he was dying. Who were the two sets of persons? Vishnudutas and the Yamadutas. And the Yamadutas expected that they would be able to take Ajamila. He was sinful. He was quite sinful. And they expected, that's right, children are welcome, unless they're screaming. So they expected they'd be able to take him, but they weren't. They were overpowered. So they went back to Yamaraj, and they said, Yamaraj, we thought you were God. But now we see that there's some superior force, because we were outpowered. We were not able with our power. We're always able with our power. We've been invincible. All this time, anyone we wanted to take, we could take. Nobody stopped us. Now somebody stopped us. They were more powerful. We couldn't resist them. That means there must be another God. We thought you were God. There must be another God. But they said, it is not possible for there to be two gods. And they gave the logic. They said, if there's two gods, then they will not always agree. Do we see this? So those of you who are married, do you always agree with your spouse? No. And if you have like co-temple presidents, okay, or if you have a board, a management board, so I'm the chair of the Shastric Advisory Council. We were trying to get, we now have 11 members, we used to only have 5. And we were trying to get everyone to agree on something. And 2-3 months were going by. And finally, one of the members called me and said, stop trying to get unanimous consensus, just take an executive decision. So this is the problem. Whenever there is more than one, there will be a difference of opinion. Just like one devotee wrote to Prabhupada, differences of opinion mean impersonalism. Prabhupada said, no, they mean personalism. Because as soon as there are two different persons, they are differences of opinion. So here you are worshipping Krishna and Balaram. Krishna and Balaram sometimes have a different opinion. When do they have a different opinion? Huh? In the war. What particularly? There was a particular incident where Krishna and Balaram had a different opinion. The marriage of Subhadra, yes. Duryodhana was supposed to marry Subhadra, and Balaram was going to kill Arjuna, actually. What was won in the war? The end of the war. Duryodhana's death. When Duryodhana and Bhima were fighting, Balaram and Krishna had different opinions. But who prevails? Krishna, even though he's the younger brother. Right? That was the view in Ram Lila, when Ram told Lakshman, you know, build a fire to test Sita. And later when he told Lakshman, take Sita to the forest. So Lakshman didn't like this very much. In traditional society, the younger brother has to obey the older brother. Is it still like that here in Mauritius? Not a little bit. Not so much. All the traditional societies are changing in the world. You can hardly find anywhere. Even you go in the Himalayas and they have cable TV, right? So Lakshman didn't like it that he had to build this fire, he had to take Sita to the forest. He said, next incarnation, I'm going to be the older brother. But even then, Krishna always wins. Didn't matter that Balaram was older. So therefore there cannot be two gods. There cannot be two independent gods. There has to be only one God. There has to be one ultimate person who can make an executive decision. So therefore, that's just logic. Putting aside Shastra, that is just logic. And therefore, these demigods are not independent gods. Even though it says here that the Lord expands as the demigods, we should understand that they are not competitor gods. The universe is not run like that. You know, you have many stories in the old cultures about demigods taking different sides. Right? We grew up studying a Greek, Roman, about, you know, there'd be a war like Ulysses, and some of the demigods take the side of the Greeks, and some of the demigods take the side of the Trojans. Did you study that in school? No, they don't teach that anymore. Because Prabhupada used to quote from these books. But we see also in the Hindu scriptures, in the Vedic scriptures, it's like that, isn't it? Even in our Bhagavatam, it's like that. When, who was it? Banasura was fighting. Shiva took the side of Banasura against Krishna even. And some demigods were on Krishna's side and some were on Lord Shiva's side. So this kind of example that even in human affairs, some of the celestials will take one side and some will take another side in some big battle or even in regular affairs. And so people who worship demigods, they're always trying, they try to choose who is the demigod they like. And then they worship that demigod. If I worship that demigod, then hopefully that demigod will be stronger than the other demigods. It's like children in a family, if the father and mother don't agree, and they think, okay, who usually wins this kind of argument? And I will take that side. You know? If it comes to food, usually my mother wins. If it comes to education, usually my father wins. So I will try to go to the right side. So the demigod worshippers are like this. But that's not really how Krishna runs the universe, ultimately. And the demigods, it's explained here, they're all jivas. Really exactly like us. In fact, pretty much 100% guaranteed, we have all been demigods. Pretty much 100%. As Prabhupada explains, when the jiva first takes a birth in the material world, it's as Lord Brahma. And then it's a gradual fall down, just like we see with Daksha. So Daksha was the son of Lord Brahma, appeared directly from Lord Brahma. And then by offending Lord Shiva, he had to take birth from the womb of a woman, Marisha, as a Kshatriya. Then he offends Narada Muni, and then we don't hear about him anymore in the Bhagavatam. You know, so we probably all did something like that. We were Lord Brahma, and then we became another birth, son of Lord Brahma, and then we did some bad karma or some offense, and then we became a lesser demigod, and here we are as a human being in Kali Yuga. Of course, sometimes the demigods come directly to take birth as human beings in Kali Yuga because of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Prabhupada gave the analogy of Westerners going to India. I mean, frankly, even here in Mauritius, it's nicer than India. So you go to India, not because of the material facility. I don't think anybody goes to India for the material facility. But people go to India for the spiritual facility. So even demigods, well, sometimes it is said in the Bhagavatam, they are lining up to take birth on this earth. Especially in the Kali Yuga, you would imagine, the worst time to come, you know, because of the spiritual facility that is here. And in fact, Prabhupada said some of our children were formerly demigods. And I know a number of our devotee children who can remember their past life as demigods. Of course, you know, we think, oh, that's very nice that my child was formerly Indra, or my child was formerly Chandra or Vayu or something. But that may make it a little difficult because they're used to everybody doing what they want and they're used to having mystic powers, and so those are not always so easy to raise children, right? They're used to just going, it rains, you know? And then they ask for something from their mother and father, and they are told no. So we have all been demigods in the past. Maybe for some of us it was our life immediately previous to this. Therefore, the demigod form is not, it's not that that's what they are. You know, so there are many, in many religions, they think that what we are in this life is what we are. You know, there is beings who are angels and there are beings who are humans. And when we go to heaven, we remain humans somehow. They think that we are this body. And they think that these higher entities are that body. But that is not the fact. We are a soul. Just like we are traveling in this body, in this life, there's so many bodies. So we can also become again demigods. So who are the devotees who will become demigods? Prabhupada explains here two things. He says those... So here you see Krishna and Balaram, they're in agreement on your altar at least, right? They're not... At least there, they're not in disagreement. But Balaram is saying, you know, I'm protecting him. Watch out. So Prabhupada says those who are rich, what does he put it, say it exactly? He says they are rich in pious acts of devotional service. So not just rich in good karma. It's very hard to become a demigod just by being rich in good karma. In fact, when a jiva does that, Krishna tries to take them out of their position. Like Hiranyakashipu, he became a demigod by doing tapasya and getting a blessing. But he was causing all kinds of trouble. I mean, he did some things that the modern scientists would like. He made all the fruits and trees bear in all seasons. So now we try to do that with importing. Right? You can import a mango 12 months of the year from some place on the planet. So Hiranyakashipu was trying to do this. He was trying to force the stopping of the seasons and to having everything always available. So, again, people might appreciate that in 2017. Oh, that's a very good leader. But he was always criticizing the other demigods very severely and for no reason. He was a very harsh ruler. And he stopped all religious practice. He was persecuting any religious person. So although he had won his post by good karma and by a benediction, so the Lord didn't like that. And therefore he did a trick. He gave Hiranyakashipu a pure devotee as a son. Because if you offend a Vaishnav, that's a higher principle than good karma. No matter how much good karma you have, as soon as you offend a Vaishnava, then it's all gone. A similar principle was there with Bali Maharaj. Bali Maharaj achieved the heavenly planets by the grace of a Brahmana, and he kept it by good karma. He was doing all these yajnas to keep it. But again, the Lord didn't like it. He wanted somebody with... Of course, Bali became a Vaishnava, that's another thing. But he wanted somebody who was a Vaishnava there. So again, he did a trick. Okay, you offend your guru. Because again, offending a guru, offending a Brahmana, offending a Vaishnava, it's a higher principle. No matter how much good karma you have. I mean, this is true even in ordinary life. If we hire somebody who has a very great record, they have a degree from Oxford and they have a wonderful work history and they're expert in everything, but if they can't get along with other people, then we will fire them even if they're very expert in their work. Isn't that the case? Especially if they're offending people. You know, you might bring a devotee here, they may be a very good cook, they may be a very expert pujari, but if they're always offending the devotees, you don't keep them around, no matter how expert they are. So what Krishna does is if people earn the position of demigods through ordinary karma or through austerity, which they can do, but if they don't have the mood of devotional service, he'll trick them into offending a devotee or offending a brahmana, and then they can get removed. Because generally, Krishna wants demigods who are not just rich in good karma, but rich in devotion, because I have to work with him. He's the big boss. He's the ultimate decider. And if they don't really have some love for him, if they don't have some affection for him, if they're just expert, then the universe is not going to run very well. Now, why does he have them at all? Why doesn't he do everything himself? Well, the jivas in the material world may also have some mood of service, and Krishna likes to reciprocate with the service mood of the jiva. I mean, Krishna doesn't need anything, even in the material world or the spiritual. We're just reading in Nectar Devotion how the Lord is not pleased exactly by the service that we render, but by our loving mood in the service. That Krishna doesn't really need, what are you offering now? Some flowers. So Krishna doesn't, I'm sorry to tell you, Pujari, but Krishna doesn't need your flowers. He has much better flowers in Goloka Vrindavan than we're able to produce even in this beautiful place. So he doesn't need the flowers, he doesn't need the food, he doesn't need the bath. Isn't that funny? Krishna needs a bath. Pavitra Amitamutaman, he's the most purifying. You just say his name and you have a bath. And he doesn't need a bath. But he likes the loving mood. We're all like that. We like a loving mood, and we will accept something given with love even if we don't need it. So even the conditioned jivas, many of them have a loving mood towards Krishna. And they want to help. They want to be of help. This is one of the two ways of the loving exchanges to Dati Pratigunati. One is giving and one is receiving. So it's also loving to receive. Somebody wants to do something for you, even you don't need it, but to be able to receive it. So Krishna likes receiving the love of his devotees. Therefore, he engages the demigods in things that he could easily do himself. Of course, if there's no one available, he expands and does it himself. He's not dependent on the demigods. And so therefore, Prabhupada also says that it has to be people, he says, when their degree to lord and over material nature has vanished. Now Prabhupada's using this absolute term, vanished. But we know that not all the demigods are pure devotees. Yes? We know this. We know that there was an Indra who tried to destroy all of Vrindavan. That's not a symptom of being a pure devotee whose desire to lord it over material nature has vanished. So there's degrees. Among the demigods, there's degrees. Some of them are more attached to lording it over the world, and some less. But all of them accept generally the supremacy of the Lord, which is why even though Indra tried to kill everyone in Vrindavan, Krishna didn't take him out of his position. Imagine if one of your board members here tried to kill all the devotees and all the cows and flood the property. I think you would throw him out of his position. I don't think if he came and said, "Oh my, I'm really sorry," you'd say, "Oh, that's okay, just don't do it again." But that's what Krishna did with Indra. He said, "It's okay, just don't do it again. Just remember that I'm in charge." So why does Krishna deal with Indra and the demigods like this? Because he knows, generally speaking, even if they mess up a lot, and I think that was the greatest example of a mess up, was Indra with Govardhan Lila, destroying to destroy all of Vrindavan. Still, Krishna understands, generally speaking, that it's actually a nice Lila for people like me, because I know that even if I really mess up, Krishna says, "It's okay, it's okay. Just don't do it again." So the demigods, they really don't want to be just independent controllers. They want to be controllers under Krishna, which is the difference between the demigods and the demons. The demons want to be independent controllers. But to be a demigod, most of them still want to have some control and opulence in the material world. Some of them are perfectly pure devotees who are taking that position simply as service. Just like Krishna told Arjuna, "You fight just as service. You fight just to set an example." Actually, it's nicely explained in the Bhagavatam. Which section? I was reading it recently. I think it's in the second canto. No, it's in the third canto. It's in the third canto with the talks between Vidura and Maitreya, Vidura and Uddhava, where Uddhava's talking about the leaving of the Yadu dynasty. And there's a section there that says, Arjuna's arrows first purified the persons at the Battle of Kurukshetra, and then when Krishna killed them, they became liberated. Because when you're first touched by a devotee, then you become purified, and then you can gain devotional service, like Yasya Prasadam Bhagavat Prasado, Yasya Prasadam Nagati Kitopi. So Arjuna, as a pure devotee, was taking that role out of service. So some of the demigods, they're pure devotees, and they're taking the role out of service, and many of the other demigods, they're mixed devotees. They want to serve Krishna, but they also think, woo, I serve Krishna, and I get to have this planet. I get to have a palace, and I get to have heavenly food, literally, and everybody praising me, and so much power, I can just go zoop, and there's a lightning bolt, woohoo! So there are demigods in that mentality. This is one of the obstacles in bhakti, as nicely explained by Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur in Madhurya Kadambini, when he talks about how various stages of bhakti destroy various anarthas. Do you know what the last anartha to go is? Wanting to enjoy the facility given by bhakti. When you're engaged in bhakti, Krishna normally will give you very nice food. Yes? Do we get very nice food? And other people will respect you. When I came into Mauritius, you know, dressed like this, the person at the immigration says, oh, Hare Krishna. Immediately there was some respect. And we see that in general. People, oh, you're a religious person. You're a saintly person. Oh, there's some respect. There's some facility. Right? And in our ISKCON, usually we give, you know, what we call the senior devotees, we give them special facility. So somebody may think, well, let me hang around long enough to become a senior devotee. Let me tolerate all the austerity of being a peon. And then, you know, I'll get some nice facility. So this is the mood of the demigods. That is their mood. Let me do a lot of bhakti. Let me do a lot of service for the Lord. And then I'll get the nice room. I'll get to stay in the VIP quarters. And I'll get the nice food, and I'll have some power and some opulence. Unfortunately, when we think like that, then we don't attain the real gift that Krishna has to give. So most of these demigods, in one sense, they're favored by the Lord. Sometimes they get to see the Lord. It's explained very nicely in Brihad Bhagavatamrita. They get to do service for the Lord. They get a nice material position. Their material miseries are much less. It's not like being in an earth body in the Kali Yuga, where we're always attacked by at least one of the miseries, isn't it? Something. It's too hot, it's too cold, it's too raining, it's too dry. We're worried about something. Something hurts. Something's biting us. Somebody's criticizing us. Well, something is going on. You know, it's not like that in the heavenly planets. In the heavenly planets, the miseries are much less and the enjoyments are much more. Now, the higher you get, the more it's like that. And you could stay birth after birth in the higher planets if you continue doing bhakti, if you didn't just use up your bhakti. Just like people come here for a vacation, they spend all their money and they have to go home. But you can also live here. So the demigods can also work there and keep up their bhakti. But we are advised, don't do this. We've already been demigods. Don't become again a demigod. And when Arjuna says to Krishna, what will happen if I fail? This is one of our big questions. Suppose I don't make it. You know, when we first start practicing Krishna consciousness, we're convinced that we are going to achieve perfection very soon. I really thought, this is so embarrassing, but I really thought that I was almost a pure devotee. I thought that way actually for quite some time. And then, you know, I'd read a nectar devotion where it says, you know, the Uttama Adhikaris all they think about is spreading Krishna consciousness, and they're following the principles. I thought, that's me. And it never occurred to me to ask, well, why aren't I experiencing unlimited ecstasy 24/7? If actually that's me. But, you know, in the beginning we think like this. Right? The Gurukulis called this the pure devotee syndrome. They said, oh, he has a bad case of PDS. So, you know, we think like that. Oh, very soon. And then the longer you're in Krishna consciousness. I was listening to one class of Bhakti Chiruswami. He said, somehow, the more you chant Hare Krishna, the more fallen you feel. Have any of you noticed this? If you're very new to Krishna consciousness, you probably shouldn't listen to this. But the longer you chant Hare Krishna and the more you do bhakti, the further and further away you feel from pure devotional service. It's actually very discouraging. And so, you know, it was just the other day that I was thinking, there is no way I am attaining Krishna prema in this life. It's not going to happen. My life is running out. I can already see the sign of the terminal train station ahead. You know, I'm way past the halfway mark. And it's not happening. It's going to be many, 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 many lifetimes. Bahunam janmanam ante. So who becomes a demigod is those who in this life, they've just made a little bit of progress. If someone makes just a little bit of progress, then they get to be a demigod next life. But that's not very advisable. First of all, after we're finished with that demigod life, Mahaprabhu's movement will be over. Because they're on a different time scale. Right? We've all read those fictional stories of someone who wanders into another dimension where time is different and they come back and the world's gone by. And we have a story like that in the Bhagavatam. Actually, regarding Balaram's wife, that his father-in-law, Kunda, I think, he went to Lord Brahma to say, where can I find a good husband for my daughter? Those of you who have marriageable sons, I've spoken to a lot of you here. How old is your child? Oh, 23, 26, or are they married? No, not yet. But of course, if you go to Lord Brahma to check it out, by the time you come back, you'll have a problem. So he came back and Lord Brahma said, all of the young men you were considering, they and their children and their grandchildren and their great-great-grandchildren, their great-great-great-great-grandchildren have all died in the 20 minutes while you were listening to this performance. He said, no one even has remembered their name. So the problem is if we go to become demigods when we come back, Mahaprabhu's movement will be over. There won't be any ISKCON Mauritius anymore. It will be gone. And people will be living in caves and eating each other. So it's not a very good idea. Unless somehow you could do pious activities to stay there. But even then, the end of the universe, then back into the body of Mahavishnu. So it's not very advised to become a demigod. Although perhaps some of us have this as our secret ambition. We are advised, take the highest thing. This was the advice that Bali gave to Vamandev, ironically out of pride. When Vamandev came and he said, what did he say? I only want what? Three steps according to my step. So you couldn't even lie down in that. I once lived in a closet in the Boston Temple. Literally, it was a closet. It had about as much space as that mat there. It was enough room for a rocking chair and some place to keep clothes, some bureau of drawers, and to put out a sleeping bag. But that's, I don't know if that would be three steps or not. So maybe three steps would be something like that, like the closet I lived in for a year in the Boston Temple. And Bali Maharaj says, you're not very intelligent. He said, you should ask from me something so great, so wonderful, that you will never have to ask anybody for anything, ever. That was why Vamandev took him down. Because who can say that? Only Krishna can say that. You should ask from me something so great that you will never again have to ask anything from anyone. And Vamandev's like, no. You don't belong here. But that's what we should be asking for Krishna, something so great. What do we ask from Krishna? We usually ask from Krishna very petty things. So right now it's Mahashivaratri, all these people are going to see Lord Shiva. I'm sure most of them are going with something to ask for. I'm sure most of them are not just going just to say Om Namo Shivaya and go home. But they have something in their mind. Even we see, you know, people circumambulating Govardhan. They have something in their mind. And we also, we have something in our mind when we're seeing Krishna Balaram. And we don't have to say it. Ishwar Sarvabhutanam Riddhesha Adhinachistati. We can lie to Krishna and we can say, please give me pure devotional service and lots of money. Krishna knows what we're really saying. Just like once when I was in Vrindavan, there was this shopkeeper who was walking past the shop, and the shopkeeper was saying, Hare Krishna, Haribo, Haribo. What were they really saying? Come, come, spend your money here. So I can understand that, and I'm just a foolish human being. So what to speak of Krishna? If I could understand that this person saying Hare Krishna was really saying, please spend your money in my shop. So Krishna can also understand what we're really saying. So we want to get to the point that we can honestly, with integrity, honestly say, my dear Lord, the only thing I want is the best thing you have to give. I don't really want anything else. We'll be discussing this in the classes on Manashiksha. So the classes have been arranged that they're going to be part one, part two, part three, but in three completely different locations. So I'm not sure how that's going to work as far as getting the same people to each class. This will be a little, we were going to do just whole thing. But they want me to do part one is going to be, what was it? The bottom of the bag. Part one will be at the bottom of the bag. And part two will be here, and part three will be in Phoenix. And widely separated by days also. So part one we're doing tonight, and part two on Monday, and part three on Wednesday. So I've never tried, this is an experiment we're going to try, to see if the same people come. I pity the people, I'll tell you something, don't only come to the one here. That will be the most depressing. It's the middle part. And that's about all the obstacles and the anarthas. So if you're only going to come to one part, don't come to that one, come to one of the other parts. But anyway, there Raghunath Das Goswami is going very deep as to how we can root out these desires for other things and how we can have only the pure desire. Because Krishna is reciprocating with our desire. And it's not what we profess to want, it's what we actually want. Krishna will give us what we actually want. Prabhupada talked about how he had a godbrother who wanted to control the properties of the Gaudiya Math. And Bhaktisiddhanta understood that, Prabhupada said. And so he engaged him in service. But after the disappearance of Bhaktisiddhanta, that devotee got the properties. But Prabhupada said he did not get the mission. Srila Prabhupada did not get the properties of the Gaudiya Math. But can anybody say he was not the main person who got the mission? Can anyone say objectively? No matter what others are doing to carry on the mission, we offer all respect to them, but we can certainly say that Srila Prabhupada was indisputably, objectively, just by looking at facts. This is not a sentimental, my guru is better than your guru kind of thing. It's just objective facts. But he didn't get the properties. He didn't get the money. He didn't get the followers. Someone else got that. Because that's what they wanted. So Krishna reciprocates with us. If we're chanting Hare Krishna, we're doing our service, and in our heart our desire is for something in this world, then Krishna will give us that. And we'll be like Dhruva Maharaj, who saw the Lord and was lamenting. He saw the Lord personally, face to face. We think, if I saw the Lord face to face, everything would be finished. Maybe, maybe not. Suppose you saw the Lord face to face and he says, okay, I know what you really want. You really want a lot of money and good health and a nice son-in-law for your daughter, and some prestige in the Hare Krishna movement. Yeah, you can have that for 30,000 years. No! And then he was crying. He said, why did I ask for broken glass? So this is not something we can artificially do. It's not that we can just say, okay, I'm now just going to want pure devotional service. I'm not going to want anything else. You can try that. You can give a good try. I've tried that. And I will tell you very definitely it does not work. And I will also tell you that if you try to cheat Krishna, it doesn't work. I've tried that also. So yeah, please just don't try it. If you go to Krishna, you say, I want nothing else but pure devotional service. I don't want anything else in this world. When actually you do want something else in this world, Krishna will take the very things you want in this world and shake them. He'll go, you stop, stop! Don't shake that! What to speak of, break it! Don't even shake it! He says, okay, what did you really want? That! Okay. Did that to me twice. After that I said, I'm not asking anymore for something I don't really want. So we have to go deep and deal with our desires. Now how do we do that? Our bhakti process is so wonderful. It's so wonderful, my dear friends. The other processes Krishna talks about, karma yoga, jnana yoga, dhyana yoga. But it's so wonderful. Our way of dealing with these deep-rooted material desires is not to deal with the deep-rooted material desires. Our way to deal with the deep-rooted material desires is to simply desire Krishna more. That's all. That's really all. As we desire Krishna more and more and more, then all these desires in comparison will be shown for what they are. How do we get people to stop eating meat? We give them prasadam. We give them something better. Then we can say, after we've given them the samosa and the gulab jamun, then we can say, do you really want to eat meat? You could have this. And then the meat eating becomes pale. So Krishna is Krishna. He's the all-attractive. Therefore, our bhakti process is to cultivate our desires for Krishna. By doing that, we clearly see, we clearly see the naked form of our material desires. We see they're nasty, they're selfish, they're disgusting, they're not satisfied, they're boring, they're nauseating, whatever. We see them for what they are, and then we automatically, naturally go, look, I don't want that anymore. And we say that honestly. And as we go through bhakti, we will see how we gradually let go of all of these things. They will surface, and we see them. We see them in their naked form, and we can let them go. We will be discussing this on Monday here in Srimana Shiksha, going through the exact process. But this is our main way. Falling in love with Krishna Balaram. I mean, look how beautiful they are. How can you not fall in love with them? And they're so much fun. Here you see they're dancing. In the spiritual world, just walking looks like dancing. What to speak of what dancing looks like? Just talking sounds like singing. What to speak of what singing sounds like? You know, they start singing and the stones melt. You know, I don't know. Some of us, we start singing, people just kind of walk away. But there they sing, the stones melt and then they reform. I mean, look at all these leelas. Such a wonderful temple room with all this original art. It's really feel like you're in the spiritual world. And even, you know, adventures, and Krishna's doing so many adventures and his dealings with the gopis. And so humorous. Here he is with milking the cow. He's so playful. And Krishna and Balaram, they're always youthful. Youthful means playful. Adventurous. God is not just like some old man. He Even in the material world with the demigods, you know, Vishnu gets on the back of Greece, stands on the back of an eagle and flies around all over the universe. It's very playful. So we become attached to Krishna, become attracted to Krishna. And as we become attracted to Krishna, then more and more and more, it'll become real that we can say, give me the best thing. Don't give me anything. What's the best thing? Years ago, I used to shop for devotees when I went to India. And you go to the store and you say, give me the best quality. They never did first. I don't know why. But never. They always brought out a medium high quality. And after many years of shopping for the devotees, I could tell. And I said, that's not your best quality. Give me your best. So we want to get to that point that if Krishna says, become Indra, we don't go, yes! No, 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 no. I want your best quality. Oh, what about one of the sages, like the four Kumaras? No, no, best quality. For Lord Brahma, best quality. It's the best quality thing. He says, oh, I don't bring that out very much because once I give that, then I come under your control. Oh, I'll wait for it, but I want the best of all. So have that desire be genuine. So questions, comments, corrections, additions, subtractions, chastisements. Yes,
Prabhu. Just the part in the Prabhu, I think it's very clarified that Krishna is the one who
No, it was, okay, let's read in the purport. Prabhupada gives two conditions. He says, rich and pious acts of devotional service. So not just ordinary karma. And when their desire to lord it over material energy has vanished. So the two things, that they're rich in bhakti, it's not just pious acts, but rich in bhakti, and where they don't have a desire to be an independent lord. If you have a desire to be an independent lord, you're not going to work well as a company employee. You don't want to hire someone for your company that is just thinking of taking your customer base and starting their own company. Yes.
And that we chose according to that, so that we couldn't choose a different incarnation. We have to choose according to those facts.
We have to choose according to the facts of karma.
So, and then we say, well, if we shouldn't wish to be neural clinical, but what if that's our next birth? Can we say no?
That's a very interesting question. So our next birth is determined basically by two different things working together. Our karmic activities and our desires, both. Because Krishna says, yam yam vapi smam bhavam tvacha chante kalevam tam tam evati kanteya sarata bhava bhavita. Whatever you think of at the time of death. Why at the time of death? This became clear to me many years ago. I was taking the Gurukul students on a field trip. You all know what a field trip is. You go out to study something in the world. I don't remember where we went that day. But when we came back, there was a fire in an apartment building. It was a huge fire. The flames were very high. It took the fire department maybe half an hour to put out the flames. And then we went to the building. We saw a young woman standing there barefoot with three young children. And when there was a fire, she didn't take her shoes, she didn't take her wallet, she didn't take, you know, the gift she got from her great-grandmother. She took her children. So at the time of death, we try to grab whatever in this life was most valuable to us, just like we would do if our house was on fire. So that's the real indicator of our prime desire. because I can say my prime desire is such and such. But if the house is burning down, it's instinctive. You just grab it. It reveals your real desire. But it's also karma. One devotee in Perth, he was talking about how when he preaches, he discusses this interplay of desire and karma. And he says, you can become a dog riding in a limousine. Yeah? You have a desire to ride in a limousine, but you only have the karma to be a dog. So you get to be a dog riding in a limousine. Or Prabhupada would say, if you're very attached to a building, you know, you built something with your own hands, it was your building, but you only have the karma to be a cockroach, then you're a cockroach in your building. So there's this interplay of desire and karma. Karma you could think of as money. But there's it's like different categories of money. We have certain karma for relationships, we have certain karma for health, we have certain karma for intelligence, we have certain karma for power, we have certain karma for knowledge. We have different karma in different areas, which is why you see some people are very rich but sickly. Or some people have beautiful family relationships but they're poor. You know, you see this sort of most people don't have good karma in all areas. So you have how much we've earned, and then we have also our desire. How do you want to spend your money? You know, you may have good karma for knowledge, but you still have some desire. Where do you want to go to school? What do you want to study? Does that make sense? How do you want to spend your karmic money? I mean, sometimes how you spend your karmic money is entirely predetermined. Just like some prison sentences, the judge cannot adjust them. They're fixed. You do this crime, you get this sentence, that's it. But most, it's not like that. You do a crime and there's a range of sentences you can get, and the judge can work with you and say, well, do you want to do community service? Or do you want to, and even after you're in prison, you can get parole and you can get out. There's some flexibility according to now. So we have this combination that we have certain karma that we've earned and then our desire. And then our karma is also indicative, frankly, of our desires. It's, you know, what we do indicates what kind of person we want to be. Do we want to be a selfish person or a giving person? I mean, even karma is intricately interwoven with desires. So for the devotee, for those of us in bhakti, Parmadi Nirtahati Kintu Chabhakti Bhajam, Krishna is thankfully not giving us our next birth based on our good and bad karma. He's not even giving us our life situations in this life based on our good and bad karma. We start working with him individually. We're not just in the automatic rule thing. I mean, even the demigods have some power to adjust karma. Otherwise, they wouldn't be able to give benedictions. You know, if the demigods just worked by karma, which is what Krishna told Nanda Maharaj, there wouldn't be any point in getting a benediction from the demigods. But the demigods have some power. Just like in a company, if you go to just the frontline clerk, they can't usually do anything for you. Their mantra is, this is the rule, sorry. This is the rule, sorry. You know, when I was traveling with my granddaughter recently in Australia, so we met up with the Australian youth bus tour, and she said, oh, Grandma, I want to go on the bus tour. So that meant changing the ticket. But I called the airline, and they said, if she doesn't fly, then she'll lose the other ticket, and you'll lose all of your ticket. I said, how much to change it? $240. And I looked at my granddaughter, and I said, forget it. But then one of the other devotees on the bus tour said, I'll pay for it. I said, you are not doing that. She said, all right, I'll go argue with the airline. So she spent 3 hours and she got, you know, can I talk to your... I just stopped at the frontline person. Then she just said, can I talk to your supervisor? Can I talk to your supervisor? Can I talk to your supervisor? And finally they changed it at no cost at all. So it's something like that. You know, if we just go on the lower level, sorry, that's your karma. Oh well. But I'm a nice person now. Too bad, it's your karma. I've changed, I really have. Sorry, that's your karma. If you go up to one of the higher demigods, then they, and you know, you do some tapasya, they say, okay, let me see what I can do. Well, I can adjust this thing and this thing. And this I can adjust a little bit. If you go a little higher even, then the demigods, if they're pleased with you, especially if you do some tapasya, then they'll say, all right, you know, we can adjust this. But even the demigods have their limit. They have their limit. You know, only the one who made the laws, Dharman Tushaksha Bhagavad Pranitam, only the one who made the laws can adjust the whole thing. So when you go to him, he can say, all right, we're putting you on a different program. You're now on, we call it an education, individual education profile, an IEP. So we now have an IEP, we have an individualized education profile. And Krishna looks at us and he says, you know, there's this thing you were due to get from karma, and I think you could still use it. I think it would still be good for you. So we're going to go with that. This thing you were supposed to get from karma, you've already understood this by chanting Hare Krishna. You don't need it anymore. We'll throw that away. And some of those may be things that we think are good, and some of those may be things that we think are bad by our estimation. We tend to think Krishna will get rid of all the bad karma and let me keep the good karma. But he's looking at everything because it's all bad ultimately. And he's saying, you know, this thing, you don't really need this anymore. We'll get rid of it. This thing would still work. We're going to keep that. Or this thing, we'll keep it but in a shorter form. You only need it for a month instead of for 2 years. Or this thing you were supposed to experience 200 lifetimes from now because it was going to take you that long to be ready for it. But I think by bhakti you're ready for it now. Wham! What up? I thought it was chanting Hare Krishna. So we get this individualized education profile. So when we're working with Krishna, we're not really going for our next birth just based on our karma. That's not the platform that we're working on anymore. That it's become, the scales have tipped much more in terms of desire instead of being much more a combination of karma and desire. But it is interesting as far as subtle karma. You know, right, Rupa Goswami says, Anushilanam. Shilanam means action. And bhakti is action on both the gross and the subtle platform. What's supposed to happen in bhakti is that we reach a point where our original swarup becomes revealed, where we start understanding, who am I? You know, right now I think I'm an old white American woman. Right? But that's not who I am. They don't have any old white American women in Goloka Vrindavan. I certainly hope not. Prabhupada says there's no sannyasis there either because there's nothing to renounce. And Prabhupada says we'll have another ISKCON in the spiritual sky. It doesn't mean there won't be GBC meetings. And, you know, not like that. So eventually our real nature, you know, maybe we're looking at one of these paintings and one day we look at it and for a moment the painting becomes alive. And we're like, oh, I want to be one of those servants combing Krishna's hair. Or I want to be one of those coward boys dancing. Or maybe I want to be the dog over there in that picture. So, you know, this desire awakens in us. And then it's explained that then what happens with our bhakti in our meditation, we start meditating on the services we'd like to do for Krishna in the spiritual world. And then we get that. That is, you could say, activity. It's a mental activity. And it's explained many places in Srila Prabhupada's books and by our acharyas that we end up doing the same service in the spiritual world that we meditated on in this life. So it should, that it does come to that. So in that kind of karma in the sense of activity, not in the sense of the law of karma, but in the sense of activity, how we meditate on serving the Lord is what we achieve. But we can't do that artificially. You can't just use your intelligence and say, well, I think I'd like to be a butterfly, so I'll meditate on that. It doesn't work like that. It has to actually awaken first in the soul. The soul has to come to the point of at least 50% free from anartis when it becomes self-manifested. So that kind of karma in the sense of activity does determine our next But no, we don't have to worry that if, you know, gosh, I've done so many pious activities, am I going to be forced, is Krishna going to force me to be a demigod if actually I've come to the pure point of pure bhakti? No. Yes. Yes, Swapa Alpa, he don't say.
And
from the worst fear, which Prabhupada says is taking birth as an animal.
So it's connected with his karma and desire, isn't it?
Yes, where Krishna says even you do a little bit. I mean, the way from the Shastra that things seem to work is if you do a little bit of genuine bhakti, your bad karma is either nullified or set aside. Otherwise, how could Prabhupada said, if someone just touches the book and says, oh, this is pretty, that's a pretty picture. He says they'll take birth in a nice family. Well, how are they doing that if they're also going to McDonald's? How is it they're going to McDonald's, but one time in their life they touch the book and say it's a nice book, and they get to take birth in a good family? And Yamaraj tells the Yamadutas, if someone one time offers obeisances, one time, but it's got to be, there has to be some emotion, it's not mechanical. It's not like just someone, okay, it's not like that. But if there's some awakening of attraction to Krishna, some mood of attraction, even one moment, what does it say in first canto? One moment of full consciousness. The other things seem to be either eliminated. I don't know if they're actually eliminated or if they're set aside. I'm not sure. There's some shastric indication for each position, so I don't know. But you're allowed to keep getting birth so you can grow that. And the other things are not, they're not operative. So one thing, because that's Krishna's main desire. And if it wasn't like that, at least I would never get out of here. You know, it wouldn't work. The volume of karma, both, you know, so-called good, so-called bad, that I've done over so many lifetimes would force me to take so many births in which I would do so much more karma. And it would never happen that the bhakti would be enough. But Krishna takes one drop of bhakti to be enough. This is what caused Pundarik Vidyaniti to go into ecstasy. This verse that how can there be one more kind than Krishna who gave the post of a mother to a she-demon? What did she do that was bhakti? She didn't even do anything that was bhakti. Really? Really? I mean, it wasn't motherly. Maybe. We don't know. Maybe she picked him up, and when she picked him up, she felt something for a moment. Of course, we know in a previous life she had, as the sister of Bali, had there was a moment of genuine motherly affection. And Krishna took that. She was trying to kill him. I mean, I don't do that. Thankfully, no one's tried to kill me. May no one ever try to kill me. But people have tried to harm me. Have we all had people who tried to harm us? Yes? Yes? Everybody's had somebody who intended to harm you, who did something to you maliciously. So I've had people like that. And I didn't say, oh, but they have one good quality. But Krishna looks at that. If someone's trying to kill him when he's a baby, and he says, oh, good quality. She can be my mother. So that's the principle. Now, if we take advantage of that, then we commit one of the greatest offenses in bhakti. If we say, oh, okay, I'm going to go be, you know, do all sinful activities and do a little bhakti and it'll overpower it. Krishna says you can't game the system like that. This isn't some sort of a mechanistic formula. Krishna is not a machine. You're not doing a mechanistic formula. It's about relationship. And if we do anything that's actually a loving relationship with Krishna, that's enough that next life we can take step two. And next life we can take step three. And the other things become not so important. The Krishna focuses on that. Isn't that nice? Isn't that nice? Therefore, why not love Krishna? Is there anybody as lovable as... Will you find anybody who will do that? Anybody? Would any of us do that? I wouldn't. Just frankly, I wouldn't. I wouldn't take one speck of good quality in an ocean of faults and just work with that. But that's what Krishna does. Therefore, he's the only one who's worshipped. Only one. Is that all right? He's so nice. We don't try to please somebody like that. I mean, speaking of myself, what kind of a fool am I that I am not putting all of my energy into pleasing such a person? Anything else? So, of course, this is Mahashivaratri, right? So perhaps we should have talked about Lord Shiva, but I assume that everyone who really wanted to hear about Lord Shiva is somewhere else, taking a long walk. So, of course, Lord Shiva has this mood of just trying to please Krishna. He has this mood of, he's not interested in anything else. He doesn't even want a house. Once to please his wife, he built a house. But then he had to give a gift to the brahmanas who came to bless the house, and the only gift he had was the house. So he immediately gave away his house. And this is our example. And Prabhupada said that you want your daughter to marry a man like Lord Shiva, who lives under a tree. But because he's so much in love with Krishna. He has this mood. He has the material energy as his wife. So he could have any material facility through his wife. But he's not interested. If I had the material energy, you know, like that, then I would say, oh, give me everything. But he says, give me nothing. And he engages the material energy in Krishna's service. So that is Lord Shiva, the greatest pleasure. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.